So it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Mark Marenko. Mark teaches philosophy at Pacific University of Forestville, Oregon. Do I say Oregon right?
You did.
Sometimes I have been corrected on that, being from the Midwest. So thank you, Mark. Mark taught here in 2009 and is back for another time, and we're so pleased to have him here. And he's going to talk about genetic testing today and all the
we're all
going to talk about that and all the ramifications. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for the introduction. Okay, I think people, maybe a few more might kind of wander in here as we get started. So just an introduction, one little personal note just for me is that sometimes I may seem a little difficult to sort of make out. It turns out that after teaching for 30 years, I still am top out in the introversion scale. So it takes me a while. I know this is kind of strange to start out, but I start out at not knowing people. It takes a while for me to get to feel, you know, totally comfortable. That if that happens in the next 5 or 10 minutes, it'll go away once we get to know each other and talk a little bit. Let's see, so introductions first, and introductions just in terms of my background and why I'm here talking about this subject. I actually started out at, I went to the Federal Theological Union. I was at PLTS. In fact, I'm kind of curious here, how many of you are actually Lutheran? Consider yourself Lutheran? Okay, most of you. What other kind of backgrounds are represented here?
Born and raised Roman Catholic.
Roman Catholic, okay. My wife Alejandra back here, and we're both Catholic as well. Although I was a seminarian at PLTS, so yes.
Presbyterian.
Presbyterian, okay.
Methodist.
Dutch Reformed,
okay. So we've got a number of significant minorities in here.
No, Lutherans wouldn't all agree with each other.
Well, I was going to say, how many of you would say that your self-understanding as a Lutheran or a Presbyterian or changed over the years, of what it sort of means, has meant to you to be Lutheran and so on, to be a person of faith? That's part of my story, actually. So I started, I went to PLPS, and I transferred at some point to Yale Divinity School. And there, at Yale Divinity School, there were a lot of other, you know, faiths there. There weren't actually that many Lutherans there. There, I wound up doing a couple of things that had a pretty profound effect on me. One was that, you know what CPE is, Clinical Pastoral Education?
Yeah.
They had a long version of that at Yale New Haven Hospital in the cancer unit, and Winchester too, in Yale New Haven Hospital. So I worked for 9 months as part of a team of chaplains, student chaplains, under the care of a Dominican sister, a Dominican nun named Mary Jenkins. Everyone I worked with, you know, passed away, died, and the families they worked with, it was a very intense year, as you might imagine. And in fact, they never did this CPE opportunity again, in part because the demands that were required of chaplains in that kind of a context. It wasn't as though we were just not trained in this. It's that we could not be as available as they needed people to be sometimes there. So that was one experience. And it wasn't that the suffering or something of that sort changed my way of thinking. But it was talking with patients where I came to the conclusion that many of the things that seemed important to me, that I imagined would be important to me if I were about to die, didn't seem to be of that much interest in them. Things like, even, you know, did Jesus walk on water, or, you know, did he rise from the dead? What does it mean for Jesus to rise from the dead, and so on? These questions, you know, so even if there's life after death, a lot of the questions that I assumed that they would be interested in trying to talk with me about weren't of interest at all. What they were interested in much more, and they would always bring me back once they got through the chaplain's badge, you know, and get through to me through the chaplain's badge, was, how do I make sense of the life that I've lived? How do I make sense of it now? What were the milestones? They would want to talk often, just to talk about these key events that seemed to reveal something important, but they couldn't quite connect all the dots. We did a lot of amateur marriage counseling for the very end. In other words, unresolved conflict, unresolved issues were big, important, but not so much these other kind of theological concerns. So that had quite a big impact on me. The other The other factor there, too, is that we were forced to be a part of a seminar with retired pastors. And week after week, we would be meeting with these pastors. And I, through that, I came to the conclusion that being a pastor takes a kind of commitment and a kind of sacrifice that I didn't know I didn't think I was really capable of. And if you think about it, pastors really have a very, very difficult job. And I could see it on the faces of these mostly men that were in this group, even to the point of questioning their decision to go into the ministry. I remember one person, this is actually a PLPS, who said, "You don't know what it's like to look over into the coffin of your own son and not be able to cry because you've been locked into this role of being in control and managing people's emotions and so on until you realize at some point you're this, everything, whenever you're in this context, you're acting." And he really struggled with this when he was his own son. So anyway, I decided to take a notch down from that and go into teaching, being academic. I went on to do a degree in philosophy at Oxford University in England. There for about 5 years, it took me about 7 years actually to complete my degree before going to the Pacific. I tell you that because how that's connected is that the same impetus that sort of led me to consider the ministry also led me to think of how I wanted to use my training as a philosopher in my life. I look back, I think of my tombstone, and look back what's going to count and what's not. And so I ended up focusing on something we call public philosophy, which is to take the tools of philosophy and to try to apply them to the problems of the day, either within profession, some particular profession, or more generally just public policy. Again, I don't want to be too depressing, but I think that just listening informally in conversation that many of us are profoundly concerned and with what's happening in our world today. And I'm not given to hyperbole or exaggeration, right? But I think we're facing problems that are killing us, and we don't know how to solve them. And we keep bashing into each other in a way through our ideological backgrounds, whether we're on the left or the right. And I think Trump is not a cause of that, but a product of that. And he may be, perhaps, for those of you, I suspect, if I ask the question where you kind of lean politically, just listening to people around the campus, it's sort of pretty far to the left, right? And so I'm profoundly concerned. I don't think about anything else, hardly. And I taught a course this last spring called Ethics in Society and decided, after a sabbatical trying to revise this course, that we were going to face head on. Students in groups of five, at the end of the term, were going to invite people from very different perspectives to come and be part of the conversation that they were going to be in control of, using the tools that they kind of learned from me and some of the things we talked about today. And I was just stunned by what they ended up doing at the end. And they were talking about things like the Me Too movement, about Black Lives Matter, First Amendment, Second Amendment. They invited gun store owners as well as others to these conversations. We talked about abortion. And, we would be wrong to say that abortion, the concerns about abortion were not, a factor, in at least one of the factors in the decision to put Trump in the office, where I think there were a number of people I talked with who said, kind of holding their nose, but he's going to put the person on the judge to get the job done with respect to Roe v. Wade, right? So abortion, we can't not talk about abortion, right? And you know what? Debates about it don't work. They don't work. So why do we keep doing the same things over and over, as though we can sort of bash each other through some kind of argumentation and to each other to convince each other that they're wrong or right, or that it's not working, so we have to find a different strategy. And that course was all about that. And tomorrow at the coffee patch, I'm going to talk about something, we'll probably be more about that. One of the things that I did, though, was write a grant to the NIH, a grant proposal to the NIH, because a colleague of mine in biology, Lisa Sardinian, and I began to think, we're getting the science here. Do people understand what the science actually is going to mean? Mm-hmm. And the NIH, in their wisdom, had a grant, a group where there was money that came out of the Genome Project that was insisted on by James Watson, actually, to set aside 4% and then 6% of the budget for the Genome Project on the ethical, legal, social, and the implications for genetic science and technology. And so we got some of that money. In fact, we got over $250,000 of that money to do a, we called it a faith forum on genetics in the Portland area. Interesting that we didn't get it the first time around, and they were looking at the reviews. And one reviewer said, there's no diversity here. You're going to be working with nothing but Christians in Portland. You need to diverse spread out, you know? And then another guy who's more in the know said, you got too much diversity here. How are you going to manage the project? You know? So we had to rewrite the program to try and explain, you know, why this was a sufficiently diverse program for the first time around, at least, to talk about genetics. It turns out, you know, you might be surprised, we had 21 different religious groups. And people who were the most difficult to work with and the least difficult to work with might be interesting to you. Who do you imagine might have been the easiest and the best and to work with on these subjects? Particularly, you think of traditions who have traditions of consensus making and consensus building. Well, it wasn't the Lutherans.
Quakers?
The Quakers, thank you. They were absolutely wonderful. They were smart. They were thoughtful. They were patient. They didn't, you know, have an agenda and building consensus. Who do you think was the most difficult?
The evangelicals.
I would have thought so too, but you know what? Not really.
Were they the AME?
No. No. It was the Unitarians.
Wow.
They couldn't agree on anything to save their life. We were constantly trying to do sort of an amateur group psychology. We were trying to get them to work together with this group. And so, yeah, you know the Garrison Keillor joke, you know, how to get rid of a Unitarian family, then the question mark on the long if you want to get rid of the Unitarians in your community, you burn a question mark on their lawn. And there was one group that started to participate, and then their leadership pulled them out. And that was the Christian Science.
Huh.
And this is an important point, just to make the outset, that why that was, why they were pulled out. Does anyone have a guess what it might be?
Too open, too much freedom to let your answers and your thoughts go where they wanted to go?
In a way, yes. If you narrow that down into specific kinds of commitments that they have, that Christian Scientists have, you've got it. So imagine a case, so we have a case where you may have Huntington's disease or something like that, say, and you're trying to decide whether to do a genetic test for some specific disease. Christian Science looks at that and they say, simply by asking that question may cause you to have the condition that you are afraid that you might have. So they're so locked into this idea, I don't mean judgment in that being locked in, because there is a connection between mind and body, right? But it seems as though they've taken this truth and turned it into something that is perhaps pretty constrictive from my point of view, or overstating the case, where they say that we can't even consider a genetic test to find out if we have something, because that means we don't know, we don't have faith, and the lack of faith itself can produce the condition that you're afraid of having. So you don't even want to think about these. So they pulled them out, and the people were very apologetic, but I didn't understand what was going on, so I just went, called on the phone to their local pastor, and he agreed to have lunch, and he eventually came out and wondered why that happened. All right, so we did this. We did do this project, which is why I'm interested in this subject. So in a sense, this is sort of a follow-up or a part of the commitment you have when you get a grant at the NIH, is to do continuing education on this, some degree of this stuff after the grant, and that's what this would be. I've got a whole bunch of slides, and I may not go through them all here. There's a problem, one of the problems with doing a course here at Fulton is that people come and they go, and then it's hard to build for the term. So the stuff I have today is sort of sets the stage for things, and I don't know how far we'll get. We'll get as far as we can. And then on Wednesday, we'll do most of our case studies, Wednesday and Friday, most of our case studies. On Wednesday, we'll be looking at a case study of a deaf couple that's looking to see if their fetus is going to be deaf or not, with the intent of aborting the fetus if and only if can hear. In other words, they only want a deaf child. They don't want a child that can hear. So we'll be looking at these sort of tensions between the autonomy we want to give people to be able to make decisions for themselves about reproduction, and at some point something's wrong with this picture, morally speaking, because you're now making decisions that are going to affect, you know, an actual person at some point. You know, what do you do when the kid says, "You mean you had me because I'm deaf?" You know, so there's a whole set of problems associated with that. Then we'll talk about cloning. I've got all kinds of studies then on cloning, two case studies on cloning on Friday. So these are all going to mix together and work together. My view is that in philosophy is that all conversations, every conversation you have, if you sustain it long enough, becomes a philosophical conversation. And if you do philosophy long enough, it does become something like theology. We are infused with the need for purpose. And every conversation, the lightest conversation we might have, if you look at it and observe it, ends with the path in going down some path. And this is, you know, also recognized by, you know, philosophers like Plato, the idea that you were born with a deposit, kind of a memory of the real world and the ideal world formed. And where our life is all about a journey, trying to find our way back to this world, you know, to this ideal. So Pythagoras, for example, talks about music. The reason we love music is because there is music with a capital M. And insofar as we sing, like last night, we're feeling that call. And Augustine talks about it this way, like the Bible. You know, the Bible are love letters from home. You know, in other words, life is about, you know, finding our way home. So you have that, and so therefore, all of these conversations, as we focus on them, we spend time with them, and we are patient with each other and listen to each other, are all part of that kind of trying to place this in this matrix of meaning that our lives are permeated with. So here, I'll just do a bit of some conceptual framework in genetic science, technology, and case studies. I've got a lot of really short clips here that are kind of fun to watch too. So to get to the genetics part, when we get through there, I want to talk about science and religion and do an embarrassingly simplistic view of taking us up through the scientific revolution and the impact of the scientific revolution on religion and politics and, you know, ideology and then into the science of genetics, right? And the reactions to that. And then we'll do a case study from a film called Gattaca. I don't know if any of you have you seen the film Gattaca. Let's go through here. First of all, this is just a quote that'll tell you more than any other, you know, what my concerns are, my passions as an educator now. This is from a guy named Neil Postman. There's a book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. If you haven't read it, if I'm going to recommend books, this is a book to read. You know, and his son has written an extended introduction to his father's book called Amusing Ourselves to Death. But, you know, modern secular education is failing. I think about, you know, the higher education in America, and I get very upset when I think about it. You know, the Kellogg Commission in the early 90s warned the institutions that the reason that the higher education exists isn't just to get people PhDs so they can write all kinds of articles for each other that maybe get cited, you know, 10 to 12 times if you're lucky and all that stuff. We have some commission, some vocation that also is intended to help make things right. So it's failing, not because it doesn't teach Ginger Rogers, Norman Mailer, and 1,000 other people are, but because it has no moral, social, or intellectual center. There's no set of ideas or attitudes that permeates all parts of the curriculum. The curriculum is not, in fact, a course of study at all, but a meaningless hodgepodge of subjects. It does not even put forward a clear vision of what constitutes an educated person, unless is a person who possesses skills, you know. And I just despair over watching my own university and others like it moving from a liberal arts, they call themselves liberal arts, to what really amounts to a kind of a pre-professional polytech attitude. Mm-hmm. I'm not blaming them because they need money. Liberal arts is classically understood is not really popular. You know, for parents who are paying $40,000 a year for tuition, they don't want to have their kids coming home saying, you know, they're learning dance theory or something, right? It does not even put forward clear vision. In other words, a technocrat's ideal, a person with no commitment and no point of view, but with plenty of marketable skills. All right. That might be overstated, but this is the picture that I feel like I exist to defeat. All right. Control of reproductive outcomes via genetic technologies, the being and the being a person, paradox of suffering. I was so happy to hear the sermon last night about suffering. It was really about suffering, wasn't it? And it's what I'm calling the paradox of suffering. It's going to be very important as we look through here. Just the idea that we're all old enough here to understand this paradox, simply put. The very thing that we tend naturally to do what we can to try and avoid, both for ourselves and for our children, turns out to be the only thing, if we look back on our lives, that have produced transitions, as Marcus was saying. I was going to call him Father Marcus. Marcus was talking about, that has mediated what turns out to be what we will protect with our lives. The things that are most important to us, if you look back in your own life, certainly are mediated through suffering. And in fact, for many of you maybe, and it's for my case too, suffering that I thought would kill me. Right? It can't be just little stuff. It's got to be big stuff that some people really die from. If it's not that, it doesn't seem to do the work. Right? So this is a paradox of suffering. It's something we want to avoid, but it's something we seem to be built to need. And also need to do something difficult. That's probably one reason why you're here too. That we're built to do things that are difficult, to try to do things that are difficult. And that produces suffering and perhaps failure. So anyway, I'm tying it into that. So let's see here. Scientific relativism, humiliarism, reactions. So just real quickly here, we're signing up for a philosophy course here, theology. But I just want to say that If you think about the world in two different ways, again, this is very simplistic and therefore misleading, but I'm going to let it ride, that Plato, on the one hand, and Aristotle, on the other, represent two very different ways of looking at the world that have had huge consequences for us sitting in the room here today. Right? And so for Augustine, he's associated with Plato. You might know that the Masoretic, you know, text of the Old Testament, the Hebrew text, was translated into the Septuagint, which is Greek. And there are many ideas that you could never get from the Masoretic text that we find in the Greek text. It absorbs the Greek categories. And so therefore, when we get to Plato and the classical Greek philosophy, Christianity really absorbed this. So they talk about, for example, if you look at the earliest gospel, Mark, it starts with the baptism of John. It's the shortest gospel and the earliest gospel, right? And you work your way through to the gospel of John, right? Which is much later, much longer, much more prosaic, poetic too. It starts out in the beginning. It doesn't start with the baptism of John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. You're not going to get that coming out of a Hebrew-oriented Masoretic text, Old Testament idea. So this interplay of the Jewish story, salvation, and the Greek philosophical categories lead Augustine, for example, then to absorb his understanding of Christianity through the Platonic categories. And Plato is all about life as a journey. So Augustine, just bear with me on this, that Augustine, very important theologian, an amazing writer and speaker too, turns out to be an amazing speaker. And he had a mistress for 15 years. He struggles with his own morality and so on and so forth. He was a bishop, you know, the bishop of Hippo. great, all over the map, this guy's psyche, you know. But he doesn't care about the world. He doesn't care about nature. You know, consider the lilies of the field and all that kind of stuff. Well, yeah, consider the lilies of the field because it's a little message from God somehow there, maybe. But you don't actually want to consider the lilies of the field, understand them biologically, right? Why? Because as Shakespeare says, all the world's a stage. There's no point in spending time trying to figure out why the rocks have these layers in them, right? Or, you know, how does this leaf, you know, how does it make it? You don't focus on that because you're wasting your time. Your job is a journey through life to find your way home, to be, you know, it's the story of salvation. The world itself is not a source of, so science then, even though science is done in little bits and pieces, it's not the focus of Augustine. This was the case all the way through until we find ourselves now in the 13th century or so with a man named Thomas Aquinas. Absolutely stunning story there. You know, kidnapped by his own parents because he wanted to become a Dominican, right? And the Dominicans were the cult of the day, you know, the Jim Joneses of the day. The Dominicans were, and so he wanted to be a Dominican. He started to go to do that. His parents kidnapped him and apparently lured him with sexy young women to try and get him to get married and so on and so forth. He finally escaped and ended up being a Dominican. Ended up being the most profound philosopher, theologian, you know, for the Western civilization. What did Aquinas do that was so different? When Aquinas first came on the scene, Aristotle was a forbidden text. He wasn't to be read. By the time Aquinas finishes his life, he's required reading. And they had rediscovered Aristotle through the Muslim world, through philosophers in the Muslim world. Right? And in fact, just at a time when Muslim theologians were becoming suspicious of Aristotelian philosophy, and they dropped the whole picture, right? Because, you'll see why in a minute, but Aquinas found some way to move Christianity from a Platonic kind of picture to an Aristotelian kind of picture. Now with Aristotle, what you have is not the language of journey, you have more the language of that we're going to look into nature to find its reality, to find the reality behind the appearances of nature. And the deeper you go into that knowledge of the world, the deeper you go into that knowledge of the world, the more you're going to uncover and see God. So for Aquinas, religion is in the world, right? And you can have the add-on of Christianity. You can get to God, right, through the world, through study of the world. Right? You can get there without revelation, but then revelation is also then something you can't get through there, and that's sort of part of it as well. But it turns out that for many, gets dropped altogether, the revelation part. And so you then have sort of natural philosophy, natural theology, natural religion that doesn't involve, you know, revelation. You got this? So now here, I'm going to show you here. This is, is anyone acquainted with this painting?
Raphael. Sure, I've seen it. It's in Florence?
If you just understand this picture, we can go on to the case study. So what do we have here? This is a different picture than we have today. This was commissioned by Julius II. It's a pope, Julius II. It was painted in 1510. Right. Now it's his post-Aquinas. So what does Aquinas end up doing, and Aristotle through Aquinas do? Opens up the world, opens up the theological world, opens that up, and says we can find truth. Anywhere we can find truth, we're going to find God. Anywhere we're going to find truth, we're going to find God. What you have here, they're hard to pick out, is you have every philosopher that there's Pythagoras there, actually, and in the middle, I'll get a close-up there, up there, there's Euclid over here, and all of these are from all places of the world who are extremely intellectually alive, insightful, and they're in this painting's called The School of Athens, It's not an actual school. It's simply a concept. And the concept is all of us together plant on the planet, Christian or not Christian, you know, with or without the revelation part, but truth seekers who love truth, right, can move forward. This was commissioned by Julius II as part of four paintings for his library in the Vatican. This is in the Vatican. This painting is in the Vatican. And it was being done at the same time that another painting was being done in the Sistine Chapel. Anyone know who created that one, right?
Yeah.
Michelangelo, we have an image of it out there, right? So at the same time that was going on, Julius II had Raphael do this. This is his most, one of his most famous.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
What's the date on Aquinas?
Aquinas, 13th century. So mid 1250.
So. Okay, so he was after the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. But I can't tell you, you can't overstate the importance of Aquinas. Mm-hmm. And mainly because he absorbed Aristotle, and that's what made the Renaissance possible. Also what I call Humanism One. Humanism One is a kind of humanism that keeps the religion in it. You don't lose the religion, and the kind of humanism that Aquinas is talking about was a part of the Renaissance. So now we're 15th century, and guess what's happening next, though? Right. Where does this then lead? Where all hell breaks loose. Well, so here's the good example. So here we have Plato. Wait a minute, this is in the middle of the Vatican. This is the Vatican, right? And these are the two central figures. And we have Plato with the Timaeus. It's a work on metaphysics, right? And he's pointing up. And he doesn't have any shoes. He's sort of more, you know, natural man there. And then we have Aristotle, who's his student, who absorbs Plato. They're not, when I say they're different, they're not different, you know, totally different. They have a lot in common. And his is the Nicomachean Ethics that he has down here. So you have the metaphysics and the Nicomachean Ethics. And look at his hand. So Plato's pointing up, Aristotle's pointing down. Plato's saying, you know, we're on a journey, only appearances, and we have to keep the conversation alive to help us understand who we are, and we gradually and slowly find our way back to the forms, the ideal, ultimately to God through that process. Aristotle's saying, no, you need to look at the world, examine what's out there. Yeah. The people that are out there, the land that's out there, the phenomena, all of the phenomena that are part of our scientific world. So there they are. So then here's what happens. Big time. Here. Three big names, five big discoveries. Anybody remember Copernicus? So it's a wonderful story. But we got kicked out, you know, to the center of the universe. And you can't have a theologian declaring that the Earth is at the center of the universe if the claim is actually something about science, right? So we move from a, you know, heliocentric or an Earth-centric theory of the solar system to heliocentric theory of the universe. Doesn't matter how you feel about it, or it's just the case that the Earth revolves around the sun. Even though it may look like the sun revolves around the Earth, it doesn't. And not even a pope, right? Not even a pope can tell you otherwise, right? Beginning at the so this is 1543. Next, Galileo. We have a good friend physicist who lives on top of our house, Todd Duncan, and we're trying to put together a course for next year, maybe here, where he'll bring his telescope up. He's a cosmologist and also an astronomer. He's got this great telescope. And we thought we'd give everyone an opportunity at night to be looking at some cool stuff in the sky, and then we'd come and talk about what we saw here in terms of the scientific revolution. And here's Galileo. There's this telescope, finally, you know, this Dutch in 1608 has this telescope. Galileo makes some adjustments to it. He looks up, he sees these moons around Jupiter. Given the theory of the solar system at the time, this was a problem. Problem to have circles and then circles going around those circles. So phases of, you can also see the phases of Venus, which also then confirmed Copernicus's theory about the sun. And he also happened to see a chance supernova, so that these weren't, the crystalline sphere weren't these stars that were fixed. Here was a star he saw that exploded, you know. So what is this? So 1605, 1610. And then William Harvey discovered the circulation. I mean, this may not sound like a big deal to you, but then this was a big deal to see that just like other animals, right, we have circulation, our heart pumps blood through our system, and William Harvey discovered that. These were kind of huge. Now, what can you derive from this? Instantly, you know, philosophers and theologians want to build on what the scientists are sharing with us, end up, you know, coming up with sort of religions of their own to bring the science in. And so you have, say, Newton, you know, that has the picture of the world, but the universe is basically a machine. The universe has fixed laws and cause and effect. I could do this 100 times, drop this stem, you know, it's going to fall, and so on, that the world is basically a machine. Well, it turns out that Newton, by the way, thought that some of his best work were actually commentaries in the Book of Revelation. People don't know that, you know. So science and religion and philosophy, all these things were still sort of buzzing around together in people's heads. But that one concept, that the universe is a machine that we can actually explore, can also lead people to this conclusion about ourselves. If we go back to the beginnings of things, we shall always find that ignorance and fear created the gods, that imagination, rapture, and deception embellish them, that weakness worships them, that custom spares them, and that tyranny favors them in order to profit from the blindness of men. So this, you know, this is one way, you know, absorbing this, saying that there are no gods out there. You know, this is it. And of course, my point of view, what it ignores is that this is a, you know, the world, as Kant says, is sort of divided up into that as human beings, we're simultaneously objects in the world. You throw one of us off the Empire State Building, it's going down, just like a rock. It's not, you're not going to have Superman come in, swoop you up, probably. You're going to go down and go splat, right? So we all have this experience, this fear, in a sense, that we are just sort of objects in the world. Except, here we are as well. I look into your eyes. I'm not just looking at your faces and your skin and so on and so forth. I'm looking at you. In other words, we're not just objects in the world, but we are also perspectives on the world. There is who-ness in the universe as well as what-ness. And once you grasp that and realize you can't escape that, this then looks kind of naive. This is a naive view of what religion is all about. All right, so let's see. So, and again, the reactions against this, now we're getting to we're really close to the genetics part of it here. There were different reactions to the scientific revolution. One of them, especially that came up through the evolution and Darwin, was this concept of meliorism. Have you ever, you know, this term meliorism? Meliorism is the belief that in progress, a belief that human beings plus technology and mastery over the materials of the world is inevitably going to cause us to constantly progress in a positive direction. It's a religious belief, in a sense. That means that, in other words, that human beings, given our nature, given our capacities for science and medicine, now you combine those things, we're heading up on our own. That leads us to the Enlightenment, too. Enlightenment values, right? Of independence of reason, right? From revelation, independence of authority, that no matter what people say, that there's a method we have now for finding out what's true and what's false, and that we need to rely on that method, not on other people telling us what's true. Enlightenment, those enlightenment values of autonomy and so on. So and the Meliorism was all part of it. So another reaction were these romantic poets. So for example, John Stuart Mill, who was sort of one of the fathers of utilitarianism, which from my point of view really isn't even a theory about morality. Wordsworth was a kind of a saving influence on John Wordsworth. John, along with his wife, actually, he was kind of crushed by utilitarianism in some ways, growing up as sort of a model of utilitarianism. But Wordsworth solve that problem for. Another of the romantic poets that were sort of reacting against this picture that Newton painted of a mechanistic universe is Percy Shelley. Now we're getting real close, right? And his wife, Mary Shelley. Mary Shelley was the one that ended up with this idea of this book, you know, called Frankenstein. And the subtitle is a modern-day Prometheus myth, you know, story. We all know the story of Frankenstein. Do you know this about Prometheus? Anyone about Prometheus? So why Prometheus? Prometheus was a titan. And titans were, so you have the god behind all gods, and then you have the second generation gods, and these are called the titans. And one of the titans was Prometheus. And then after the titans, you have the Olympians, and you have all of the gods of the Olympians there with Zeus and so on. So Prometheus did a couple of really bad things, right? He got in trouble. Prometheus, one of the things he did is he created man. He created human beings. And he got punished for that. Second thing he got punished for, he not only created man, but he gave him fire, the first great technology. And the punishment for Prometheus was that he would be held up, and then an eagle would come and slowly eat his liver, and then he would then grow a new liver the next day and have the same thing happen to him forever, right? Because he created man and gave him fire. And so this is the first, and why is this, you know, part, why is Mary Shelley referring to the Frankenstein myth then as a Promethean myth? Why is that, you think? What's the connection there? Right. So watch this, man. Why not actually see it? This is the... Let's see if this actually works. Get all these lights and stuff going on here. But to get them alive, he's got to go where? Outside the building. Okay, I'll scrape it up. Isn't that a great scene? So direct and dramatic. Now I know what it feels like, you know, to be God. Right? So this is, again, the Promethean myth, the idea, you know, you provide human beings with some really effective technology, they're going to do something bad with it. You know, the fire with Prometheus. And then now, you know, with science. That science is going to try and do this. This is Mary Shelley is saying, you look forward, this is what we're about. This is where human nature sort of leads us. Maybe Augustine is a better picture than Aquinas, right? That one, you know. So technology. Now, let me move on to this. Now, this is this is a quote in the Phaedrus, a book written by Plato. It's about the invention of a new technology. You'll realize what it is here in a minute. And then the king's response to this invention. So the king has this technology science guy come to him and offer him different things. And this is one of the things he's offering. And the king says, well, I don't know if this is such a good thing or not. So here it is. So Thamus then replied, Thuth is my paragon of inventors. The discoverer of an art is not the best judge of the good or harm which will accrue to those who practice it. So it is in this, you who are the father of writing, so this is the new technology, writing. It wasn't always the case that we had writing. Have out of fondness of your offspring attributed to it quite the opposite of its real function. Those who will acquire it will cease to exercise their memory. Why memorize something if you can just carry it around in a book? Those who acquire cease to exercise their memory become forgetful. They'll rely on writing to bring things to their remembrance by external signs instead of their own internal resources. How many infinite light years are we away from this, you know? And is that progress? How do we think about it? What you have discovered is a receipt for recollection, not for memory. And as for wisdom, your pupils will have the reputation of it without the reality. They'll receive a quantity of information without instruction. and in consequence be thought very knowledgeable. All the men in black IT guys, you know, in their life. Very thoughtful, knowledgeable, but when they are, for the most part, quite ignorant. And because they are filled with the conceit of wisdom, instead of real wisdom, they're going to be a burden on society. So suspicion. That's the suspicion of technology. Now, we would love for our kids to read, you know, instead of just watch videos right now. I mean, reading is very important. So, but the technology has an impact everywhere. Neil Postman, again, wrote another piece on technology, and he says that technology does five things, and we need to look at those five things before we absorb them. And genetics is one of them, right? So, let's see here. Idea one he has is that we need to ask the question. These are five questions. What will a new technology do is no more important than the question, what will a new technology undo? And that's something that, you know, the Amish are real good at, for whatever you think of the Amish, another category. You know, whatever comes into their community, it's looked at before they decide to bring it in. Whereas what we do is that we get the technology pushed on us because people want to make money and we want to experiment with things. We then adapt to the new technology, and then at some point we go, yeah, this is doing something for us that we like, but now we're discovering it's also doing something to us that we don't like. And guess what? We're stuck now with it. You know, when I first came up to Holden, they had an emergency telephone, satellite phone. And you know, then they installed internet connectivity. You only could be in a certain room to do that. Now there's Wi-Fi throughout. It's slow, you know, very slow. When I come back in some other time, you know, maybe it'll be faster. I'm not all sure that's, you know, really it's a good idea, especially for a place like this, but what do I know? You know, that we find ourselves. So I remember we were at Weber Alley in Bend, Oregon. There's this motorhome that pulled up and the camping spot. And these people came out and they put their chairs down, opened up the side of the motorhome, and there was this television with a bar next to it. They turned on television, and there they were in the middle of nature, sitting there in their chairs watching a television show about nature. You know, what is that? So that's idea one. Idea two, the advantages and disadvantages of the new technology are never distributed evenly. This means that every new technology benefits some and harms others. Third idea, embedded in every technology, there is a powerful idea, sometimes two or three powerful ideas. He's largely here writing in the context of his critique of television, the development of television, but it applies elsewhere. Four, technological change is not additive, it's ecological. All that means is, say you have some ink, right, and you put it in water, the ink blob doesn't go down. It's not like you have a glass of water with an ink blob in it. You now have it dispersed throughout the culture. So he wants to say that the United States that we had before television was not the United States we had after television, that it affects absolutely everything. And he wants to say that television had terrible impacts on education, on religion, and on politics, that we're almost incapable of having a serious, sustained, potentially fruitful political conversation. It's almost impossible. This is going to be a little challenging for you to say this. He wants to say, Sesame Street never taught any kid to love anything about school. Sesame Street taught kids to love television. And therefore, every educator since then is in competition with Big Bird, you know, to get their teaching evaluation, right? And so on and so forth. That they changed the education. When you think about what needs to be education, you gotta be humorous, you gotta make, you know, certain kinds of jokes and be a certain personality, you keep people awake, all that kind of stuff, instead of working together, you know, to come to some picture. And that's because that he wants to say that technological change is not additive, but ecological. Same with our phones. We all have them with us right now. Most of us have it with us, even up here. We've got our phones with us, right? And mine. So So what's happening to us is as important as what these things are doing for us. And we haven't thought about that. We don't have what I call techno-critique commensurate with the seriousness, you know, of the effects that it's having on us. Way true for genetics, too. The last one is that the fifth and final idea, which is that that media tend to become mythic, or technology becomes mythic. By mythic, this is a kind of a technical sociological term, meaning that the technology becomes effectively part of nature. And our phones have become that. If you don't have your, some people, if you're 15 minutes without your phone, you're feeling for it. You know, I think that becomes, and like my daughter, when she turned 15, it wasn't like, you know, Dad, can I have a cell phone? It was, so where, you know, where's the phone? You know? In other words, it became a built-in expectation that you'd get some kind of a smartphone when you turned 15. I don't know where that rule came in. But, you know, I gave a television myself in 1988, and people looked at me like I was on some other planet. You know, I didn't even have it. You don't have, just like saying you don't have a refrigerator in your house. You don't have a refrigerator. And a lot of people say, well, I don't watch a lot of TV, and so on and so forth. But a few people say, I don't own a television. So, you know, when the kids grew up kind of without that there, and their friends would have been, oh, my God, I really didn't even come over to our house. It's a part of nature, you know.
Yeah.
So, and that's a problem. And then Pope John Paul II, here's something he says, that science can purify religion from errant superstitions. So now we're coming in the 60s, this picture here. Religion can purify science from idolatry and false absolutes. But that means we need to be smart, we need to do our research, we need to be faithful. And we need to take stands on stuff that might be unpopular. And not give in to this, what I call argumentum ad inexorabilum, that is to say, the argument from inevitability. And unfortunately, what we do, I think, is that once we get the idea that, you know, why is he talking about the Wi-Fi at Holden Village? There's no way they're going to get rid of that, so forth. You know, so why bother doing that? In fact, there might be some good reasons for having Wi-Fi up here. Then you start building on that. Pretty soon, you're defending the thing because you think it's inevitable. You feel like you need to somehow justify it yourself. And that's a lot, from my point of view, it's a logical fallacy. It's a thing, lacks critical thinking. Just because something's inevitable doesn't mean we shouldn't take a stand against it. Right, I think. All right, so then genetic science, so here we go. So Plato's Republic, it's not as though heredity is something that just, you know, popped up with Watson and Crick and so on. Plato's Republic suggests that, you know, the best way, if you want to, you know, preserve your community, is to breed people who are athletic to be the defenders of the community. So you only let people who are really good at sports breed with each other, people who are really good musicians breed with each other, and so on. So you build up these groups. They didn't understand anything about heredity or the rules or how it works, but they did know that there's this sort of one thing follows from another idea, and that roughly speaking, people are tall, that's a history of tallness, there's going to continue that trait, and if you want to build that, you only breed people who are tall, right? So, but then we end up with like Mendel. Again, this is a product of the scientific revolution. So here's a priest, you know, a monk, who's doing experiments. He's a good student of Thomas Aquinas in the Scholastics, right? And he was very good at keeping records, a lot of detailed data, and with peas, no one thought he was doing anything important in the world at all. And he discovers the rules of inheritance. And he doesn't know the mechanics behind it, but he began to understand how the mechanics of inheritance work. And then you find a cultural, you know, there's always science and then a cultural appropriation of that science. And so you have the Thin Man, Myrna Loy, and Dash Hamill, who wrote these great stories. You know these people?
I have no idea what that is.
William Wordsworth. Okay, so the Thin Man, this series of Thin Man. Here's just a quote, a quick clip from them. Now, yesterday, this is in 1930s. This is way before Watson and Crick. So this is a great little clip, I think.
All I know is that I want you to marry me right now.
I can't marry you. I can't ever marry you.
Dorothy!
I'd like to have a couple of little murderers for your children. That'd be fun, wouldn't it? Perhaps they'd all murder each other and keep it in the family. But That's what Father should have done. He should have killed Gilbert and me, and then we wouldn't have had all this to go
through. Dorothy, you're talking like a crazy person.
Why not? I am crazy. All our family is crazy.
Dorothy, listen to me. I love you. Do you understand that? I love you.
Okay, that's not the end. I have trouble keeping the footsteps.
Poppy. Please go. Go.
You know, you're wrong about all of your children being murderers.
Nice people.
Now, I've studied the Mendelian law of inheritance and their experiments with sweet peas. And according to their findings, and they've been pretty confusing, only one out of four of your children will be a murderer. You must have three children. No, that might not work. First, it might be the bad one. But that's not better.
I love that clip. And notice a couple of things here. One, you know, he's got the glasses and he's got the big book.
Yes.
And he's going to solve this problem for someone. You know, we're going to use the science, the technology to solve a problem, this terrible problem, someone you care about. So you can't help but feel sort of empathy with him. And then you realize he doesn't know his thought. You know, he's referring to the Punnett squares, and you can work out all that. So, but then he realizes, well, if it's a one in four chance, you know, it's still the first one could be the bad one. Right. But also notice, what does the man, what is the man saying?
Doesn't matter.
Because I love you. Yeah. I love you. It's not about your genetics. It's about, I love you. And we intuitively understand what it means to say that you love someone. Right? And we get lost in all this stuff with somehow pretending like we don't know what that means. So DNA revolution with Watson Crick, also with Franklin Wilkins, and Linus Pauling, by the way, was damn close. He was very close. He could have been the one that discovered the DNA. He was very close conceptually to working out the double helix theory. And Franklin and Wilkins were people that Watson Crick didn't really give enough credit to for coming up with the discovery of DNA. But Watson Crick really did put all the pieces together to come up with the model for DNA. Now, this is, does anyone know this painting at all? Anyone seen it before?
No.
This is by Salvador Dali, 1963. And he had a conversation with Crick, Watson, actually, at one point. He also did a Playboy interview in which he said that Watson and Crick's discovery was the strongest evidence for the existence of God that he ever saw. And James Watson said, I mean, it had the exact opposite effect. So people respond to what they know about genetics in wildly different ways. But I mean, here is a weird painting. So just a little bit what you're looking at here, down here, you've got these molecules, but they're actually Arab, with Arab turban type things. They all have rifles, and there are little groups of four, and the idea is one shoots one, they all shoot, and there's that. This is his wife, Gayla, in here, so the love of his life, watching all of this happen. And then up here in the corner, that is Isaiah, the prophet, holding a scroll with the name of this painting, which is Gala Alacidus Oxyribonucleic Acid. That's the name of this painting. That's what Isaiah's holding. Isaiah the prophet, right? And he's right near, this is Christ. This is Christ who is actually being lifted up into heaven to be revived. And there's his wound down here, the blood, the wound here. And here's what Dali says about the painting. He says, at a time when the titles of pictures are rather short, I call my homage to Crick and Watson, except what I just said. It is my longest title in one word, but the theme is even longer, long as the genetical persistence of human memory. As announced by the prophet Isaiah, the Savior contained in God's head, from which one sees for the first time in the iconographic history, his arms repeating the molecular structure of Crick and Watson, and lifting Christ's dead body so as to resuscitate him in heaven. I don't know what that means, but it sounds really profound. Something's going on in his head there about this painting, but obviously had a big impact, the discovery of DNA. Okay. So again, our attitudes towards nature. This is maybe you've seen. You know what this is?
Well, I didn't know you were so fine on the vine.
Well, there's a lot you don't know.
I'll bet you don't know about this.
Oh, come on. That's a stick of my sweet, creamy butter.
Like chiffon stick margarine.
Chiffon stick.
As you know.
She just happens to have it with her.
Margarine.
Right, chiffon fooled you.
It's not nice to fool Mother Nature.
Okay, so obviously what's the two things to notice here. One, it's got this message, don't mess with Mother Nature, right? But we're laughing. Now, watch this here. So, let's see. This is from a movie called Lilo and Stitch or something. Mm-hmm. I've never actually seen it. You know what this is?
Well, it's a great movie.
Pardon?
It's a great movie.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, wait to hear what I have to say about it. I hear it's a great movie and great themes, and there is. And in the end, it's like there is a gospel kind of message to it. But let's look at this. So this is the first part of it.
Read the charges.
Dr. Jumba Jukima, lead scientist of Galaxy Defense Industries. You stand before this council accused of illegal genetic experimentation.
How you plead?
Not guilty. My experiments are only theoretical and completely within legal boundaries.
We believe you actually created something.
Created something? That would be irresponsible and unethical. I never, ever make more than one. What is that monstrosity? Monstrosity! What you see before you is the first of a new species. I call it Experiment 626. He is bulletproof. Fireproof, and can think faster than supercomputer. He can see in the dark and move objects 3,000 times his size. His only instinct to destroy everything he touches.
So it is a monster.
Just a little one. It is an affront to nature. It must be destroyed.
Calm yourself, Captain Gantu. Perhaps you can reason with him. Experiment 626. Give us some sign you understand any of this. Show us that there is something inside you that is good. Not!
I didn't teach you that. Place that idiot scientist under arrest. I'm prepared to be called Evangelion.
And as for that abomination, it is the flawed product of a deranged mind. It has no place among us. Captain Gunter, take him away.
With pleasure.
Okay, so it escapes. And wreaks havoc in the world, chaos in the world somehow. And then, but at the end of the movie, here's what happens.
This is my family. I found it all on my own. It's little and broken, but still good. Yeah, still good.
Okay, now, it's a touching ending, and he has this sort of conversion, this monstrosity, right? What's the cultural message here about genetics, genetic engineering? What's being the applied message here?
Give science a chance.
Pardon?
Give science a chance.
Give science a chance, yeah. And after Frankenstein, after Jurassic Park, after all of these films, or Blade Runner, you know, I'm talking about Blade Runner with the replicants and so on, all these fears we have about genetics. Here you have this terrible genetic thing that's been created, it's let loose in the world, and yet the power of love and the power of humanity can somehow change it so that it's going to work for us, right? I think that's called the Stockholm Syndrome. Are you following what I'm saying here? Stockholm, what is the Stockholm Syndrome? Fall
in love with captors.
You fall in love, you fall in love with your captors, or you, some people who are in a position where they have no control over what's going to happen to them. I don't know if you've ever been in a situation where you really feel like you have absolutely no control over what's going to happen to you next. You can live or die, doesn't matter. I had an experience of being kidnapped once, and it was a short period of time. But that's the only time in my life I had that feeling that whether I was dead or alive, what happened to me, I had absolutely no difference to the two people in the car with me, right? You have this experience, and you begin, that one of this phenomena is that you begin to identify with the people who hijacked the plane, or have somehow, you know, captured you for doing these things. So you identify with them as a coping mechanism, right? So you could view this in that kind of light.
Pardon me.
Yeah.
With regards to your example of the Martian, was that a setup for fooling Mother Nature or something slightly deeper? Because we all laugh.
Yeah.
But the Martian is a complete hoax with regards to the benefit of which it was supposed to provide.
Well, that's true too.
Right? It actually ends up killing more people.
That's a good point, yeah. Margin didn't work out too well either.
Right. It was relatively interesting that it was a hoax of which we were sold a bill of goods, and it's actually more harmful.
That's right.
And yet I laughed at your clip.
Yeah, right. But I mean, I guess what I'm saying is that you have people like Salvador Dali, and you have people like Mary Shelley who view things, or are not Salvador Dali, but you have people like Mary Shelley on the one hand, Salvador Dali on the other, who view these things with fear and trepidation, and others who don't, see them as exciting. And that's what we're talking about with genetics, right? So and here's what happens with us bioethicist types, right? So here we have 2015. Scientists seek ban on method of editing the human genome. You know, what we're talking about here is called CRISPR-Cas9, mm-hmm. right? The invention, it was new there. And then look at the next slide, though. Here it is. Again, New York Times, it's February 2017. Human gene editing received science panel support. So it only took 2 years to go from the, oh my God, you know, we really need to stop and take a close look at this, to getting support for doing experimentation with CRISPR-Cas9.
In human history, is there anything that we've turned back away from?
I don't know. I mean, we
Margarine.
Is it butter right here?
It's butter.
Yeah, it's good. It's good stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't know. And I guess your point is that again is the question about the inexorability. You know, are we truly at this point unable to do anything about whatever it happens to be that is the new technology out there? Do we have anything to arm ourselves with to protect us from what we see as potential harms? You know, and I want to say we do, but I'm a Kantian. I don't believe that there's hope or not hope. We have duties, not. In other words, we may or not feel a sense of hope, but from Kant's point of view, and I think from the point of view of faith, that even if we believe the ship is going down, it matters what we're doing on that ship. So I try not to think too much about where we're going right now. Because of CRISPR-Cas9, I mean, let me just show you here. This kid, right? Keone Gandel. He barely got a high school degree. He was kicked out of the science fair because he was doing experimentation. You can buy a kit, a DIY kit, for doing gene editing with CRISPR-Cas9. That's what he's doing here in his home. He's a research fellow at Stanford University.
Wow.
He explains to me. Right? And here's, if you want, is that time for us to go?
No, that's just the beginning of lunch.
Okay, then that'll be just to set up what we'll do on Wednesday then is the DIY gene editing game's popular. Someone is going to get hurt. Look at the date. It's just, you know, just really recent, 2018. If you're going to read anything about the newest of the technology, this would be it. Maybe I'll see if I can get some copies of this just to have Brown to take a look at this. It's a really well done article because they've actually produced horse pox, for example. They haven't produced, smallpox, but something that's similar to it, and already reproduced horse pox. The ability to use Cas9 to create microbial weapons is enormous. And they're selling these kits for $130 for doing some basic gene editing. Yeah. And Watson, Watson says, you don't worry about our lifetimes. We're not going to have the kind of technology to be able to edit genes. I'm sorry, we actually do. So Gattaca Plantation Genetic Engineering is what we wanted to look at here. So the clip I'm going to show you is from Gattaca, and that's where we'll end with this bit because that's what it's all about. And I have transcripts here, but you just watch this real closely. Again, I'm really aware of the time, so I don't want to set it up too much, but it's a movie in the mid-1990s about the shift from a phenotypic to a genotypic world in which people are becoming more and more normal for people to be engineered. Two brothers, and one as Vincent, who you'll see here, who was conceived in the normal way, and then his brother, because this was a failure, they decided to go to the geneticist to engineer the second of the siblings, right? And the whole movie is about the relationship between these two, the one who's not genetically engineered and the one who is genetically engineered. And the movie itself is not, not that great, but there's some really amazingly good scenes in it. But here's where Vincent is given birth.
I was conceived in the Riviera, not the French Riviera, the Detroit variety. They used to say that a child conceived in love has a greater chance of happiness. They don't say that anymore. I'll never understand what possessed my mother to put her faith in God's hands rather than those of her local geneticist. Ten fingers, 10 toes, that's all that used to matter. Not now. Now, only seconds old, the exact time and cause of my death was already known.
Neurological condition, 60% probability. Manic depression, 42% probability. Attention deficit disorder, 89% probability. Heart disorder, 99% probability. Early fatal potential. Life expectancy, 30.2 years. The name of the certificate?
Anton? No, Vincent and Anton.
Every skinned knee and runny nose was treated as if it were life-threatening.
I'm sorry, the insurance won't cover it. If he fell...
But I was told that everything was...
I really wish there was something I could do.
Like most other parents of their day, they were determined that their next child would be brought into the world in what has become the natural way.
Your extracted eggs, three, have been fertilized with Antonio's sperm. After screening, we are left as received two healthy boys and two very healthy girls. Naturally, no critical predispositions to any major inheritable diseases. All that remains is to select the most compatible candidate. First,
we may as well
societal agenda. Have you given it any more?
We would want Vincent to have a brother, you know, family.
Of course you would. Hello, Vincent. You have specified hazel eyes, dark hair, bent. I've taken the liberty of eradicating any potentially prejudicial conditions, premature baldness, myopia, alcoholism, and addictive susceptibility, propensity for violence, obesity, etc.
We didn't want, I mean, diseases, yes, but...
Right, we were just wondering if it's good to just leave a few things to chance.
You want to give your child the best possible start. Believe me, we have enough imperfection built in already. Your child isn't needing additional versions. And keep in mind, this child is still you, simply the best of you. You could conceive naturally 1,000 times and never get such a result.
Okay, so this is the sub. That transcript, I have a transcript of this, and on Wednesday, we'll spend half the period looking real slowly at this conversation. What's in this clip is just amazing. First of all, you know, so if you see them here, I mean, if you're gonna, yeah, you're gonna concede in the car, this is a really nice one. The window and everything there. Now, but what are they doing? They don't need to be quiet here, but what are they doing? There's a number of ways you can describe it. Some maybe more socially acceptable as what are they doing?
Getting ready to do it.
Or maybe having just then.
Yeah, I mean just.
But so what do we call this?
Having sex, making love.
Okay. What are those? First is having sex. The second might be making love. Right?
Responding.
Not necessarily those are the same thing.
Responding in an environment to some built-in urges.
Right. Right, sure, yeah. And they look, you know, they look like they're, this is a partner, they're partnered, they're fully intending. So one thing we can say that they're doing is they're reproducing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is reproduction happening, we're watching that. What are they doing here?
Analyzing.
What else are they doing?
Overthinking.
They're thinking real hard about what?
Reproduction.
They're doing the same thing, they're reproducing. And at some point in the film, you saw her say, well, wait a minute, you know, diseases, yes, but we're wondering if you could just, right? These poor folks here, you know, in the suit and tie, and looking at them pensive and anxious, dependent on the knowledge of the person across from them. These aren't the same, this isn't the same thing they're doing when they were in the car. But this is reproduction. They're reproducing. And they're in saying this, you know, is there something you can leave with? It's the last pathetic distillate of what it meant to reproduce in that first in here, right? Mm-hmm. Like they wanted to preserve something they could understand that's associated in their minds with what it means to reproduce, to have a child. And just to be up just a couple minutes, here's one thing he says, here's Anton. They name the child. They find out he's going to live for maybe around 30 years, right? He's disappointed. They ask him, what's the name on the birth certificate? Marie says, Anton. We're going to name him after his father. And his father says, I don't want to have him called my name. Mm-hmm. We'll have him named Vincent Anton, middle name, right, to preserve Anton for his real son, you know, who's coming next, right? So, what is that? Marie is asked, you know, looks at Vincent and says, you'll do something, you know, there's something you'll do. In other words, they now know that he's defective, and they still love him, and they want to do something to help him, but they know he's defective, so they're going to treat him as defective. Psychologists call this labeling. Labeling means that you project onto the person certain qualities that they eventually, because they've been projected on them so long, they actually take on this self-understanding of the label. Kid doesn't have a chance in that sense, you know, once we know that much about a person's genetics at birth. And then what does he say? He says he tries to reassure them and say, look, there's enough imperfections in the world already. And then she looks down at Vincent. Who is Vincent now? He's the imperfection. And you can conceive a thousand times, he says, and never achieve. It's still your genetics. You can conceive a thousand times, you can never produce such a result. So the discussion we're going to have then is about the extent to which this control that we now have, this is not science fiction, the extent to which the control that we have over the outcomes of reproduction, the fine-tunedness of it, the accuracy of it, and the drama of it, what impact is that going to have on our self-understanding? And then the last question will be, as people of faith, what kind of stance do we have? What do we have to say in this context?
You're going to do all that on Wednesday?
Yeah. We'll be in groups of five and so on, or sort of smaller groups a little bit to discuss this transcript. I'm going to go really slowly through it so we can talk, and I'm going to have a notepad myself so that I can get your insights into this as well.
About the
I think it's pretty close to 12 now.
Yeah.
All right, thank you all.